Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Candace Walsh. She is the editor of the new anthology, Ask Me About My Divorce, Women Open Up About Moving On. And we are also joined by Rosie Kennedy and Sally Blakemore. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Thanks.
Hi.
And there's going to be this Saturday, June 13th, from 2 to 3, an event at Garcia Street Books, a book launch for this book. So, Candace, you put together this anthology. It's all writings by women who have been divorced. How did you come to make this anthology? Obviously, there's a personal story behind it.
I felt like divorce needed a makeover in the way that it was perceived by our culture at large. I knew that it was an upsetting thing because it's not what you plan to do when you get married, but I felt kind of overwhelmed by everyone's responses to my own news that I was getting divorced, because their responses assumed that it was catastrophic and kind of would just leave behind scorched earth. And for me, I felt a large sensation of freedom and rebirth and lots of room for potential to kind of unwind. And I wanted to strengthen that message with this book and collect the stories that I had heard when I was going through it.
Obviously, there is the theme of grief, which we will get to in a moment, but a lot of women do experience this sense of relief and happiness when they separate from what has turned out to be a bad marriage.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we have three of us here, actually four, including me, because I am included in this book, and we're all going to read a little bit about our own experiences. But I think all of us growing up felt that divorce was a really bad thing. It was just an inherently bad thing. Maybe not quite as bad as terminal illness, but pretty darn bad. Did you have to deal with Sally? I mean, you are probably half a generation older than we are. Did you have to deal with those problems, that perception?
Oh, I think it was worse in the 60s before the revolution really happened, sexual revolution. Because at that time, you didn't realize it, but you were chattel. You were owned, and the whole system put you in a box that you could not get out of, and you didn't really discover it until you were married, and it was suffocating.
And so what were some of the ways in which we are freer now?
I think there's still a problem with women in America having freedom that we perceive that we have, because when you get close to an event that you need to go through, or are even aging. Aging is the huge wall in America. You want to stay young. You've got to use these products. You have to go through plastic surgery. So there's all these ways
to... You have to?
Not me.
There's all these ways to encapsulate women and define women from the outside, when women really must define themselves from within.
What we can do is start by having the four of us read from our work. Rosie Kennedy, do you want to read from your essay?
Yeah, sure, I will. I mean, I wanted to give a preamble to that, too, and just say that I think the devastation factor of a divorce really is largely depending upon if you are the giver or the receiver of the cease and desist order.
Right.
You know,
like in all breakups.
Absolutely. You know, in my situation, it was just sort of like a fizzling out. And so I think we were both so out of our bodies and mind by that point anyway, that it was just sort of like, it was almost like a non-event. And it really only took on meaning after the separation happened for me. And I guess I'll sort of read about that in this section, which is coming back to terms with that passage of time and with the reflection looking back and trying to figure out how I emotionally situated myself vis-a-vis that experience after nearly a decade and having remarried and started a family. So I'm going to read about that. And what it is my husband, and who is my husband at the current time, and I foresee forever, and I and my young oldest daughter went to London, and my ex-husband came up to visit us. And here we go. And I will refer to him as P. P took the channel up to meet ma petite famille. I was distressed and saddened to find a bitter man before me. He complained that he was in a relationship that was ending poorly and with some measure of violence. He is the ultimate pacifist. He and my husband circled wagons somewhat warily, though my husband was actually honored to meet the man who had once loved me so fully and who still held my memory dear enough to come up to London to bear witness to my new life. I told my husband that made him sound rather heroic, and he joked that he is. I felt very sorry for P. He felt sorry for himself too, and it made it clear that he envied my happy life, my family. He felt like a loser. We had a very somber lunch, and even my lightheartedness didn't lift the mood. This time on the plane to the United States, I was elated to be getting away. In 2004, 14 years after leaving Bristol, I returned to Paris for the first time as a middle school French teacher with 13 students in tow. I imagined it would be emotionally overwhelming to return to mythical Paris after 15 years, and I warned my students not to be alarmed if I burst into tears when visiting certain monuments. But in the end, there were no tears. I was extremely happy and grateful to be there again. It was a simple joy of past familiarity and marking of the passage of time. On my day off, P met me at the Picasso Museum, something we had never found the time to do together. We had a wonderful time looking at the art, a delightful lunch, and I climbed on the back of his bicycle. He had become an ardent follower of the Green Party, and he rode me all the way up to his apartment across the city. It was a gorgeous sunny day, not unlike the one of our wedding, I suppose. The bike ride was very long, and the cobblestones hurt my butt. I was quite impressed by how strong he had become. He also had a little bit of a pot belly and thinning hair. I no longer had anything like a flat tummy, but I thought I still had a sense of cheap creative style. We must not have looked that different from all the regular people out and about in Paris that day. To steady myself on the back of his bike, I put my arms around his waist like one would do at a friend's husband in a conga line at a tacky wedding reception. He seemed intent on impressing me with the order and affability of his life, and I was pleased to be gracious and obliging. We arrived at the apartment where he lived with his girlfriend of 3 years and their nearly 2-year-old daughter. How thrilled I was that he had finally accepted that settling down was not a form of bourgeois death. His girlfriend was wary, but kind enough. I could tell this was not easy for her, and I wanted to reassure her that there was no reason to be uptight. I hadn't cared for him in anything but the most diffuse way in almost a decade. Those 7 years together were consigned to memory and subsumed by our new lives. But I just played it all off by being blithe and jovial, the Rosie of 1,000 cocktail parties and 1,000,000 glasses of Kir Royale. Their baby was asleep. I peeked in to see her, and I was choked with gratitude and admiration for this fidgety French woman who had given P what he needed out of life and what had never been my role to give. His girlfriend, C, made a lovely dinner of crustaceans, and we drank wine and listened to Boris Vian records. P burned me a couple of discs of nostalgia music, which my own children find hysterically bizarre, all tubas and cha-cha-cha. He asked me to stay on longer into the night so we could all talk and make new memories of camaraderie over another bottle of wine. I was sleepy and had a full day of sightseeing ahead with my charges, so I got a cab and went to bed, feeling just content at how beautifully everything had evolved.
Rosie Kennedy, from the book Ask Me About My Divorce, Women Open Up About Moving On. So just to contextualize that, you had, at a pretty young age, in your 20s, met a Frenchman, gotten married, and...
Well, I met him in my junior year abroad. I had the quintessential junior year abroad experience. You know, I met a French man, young, sexy Parisian, fell in love, moved back, finished my senior year, and moved back to France with him after graduating. We stayed together for 7 more years after that. the final year of which we lived in England, in Bristol, in the UK. And it was at that point that, you know, our relationship just sort of fell apart. Maybe I was more married to Paris, you know. I mean, reading this again, my trepidation was about returning to Paris and seeing monuments and not seeing him.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was just like he was the means to the end. That sounds crass, but I'm not sure. I'll have to think about that. You know, I mean, I think I was so young and we were so committed but also uncommitted. When you're in your early 20s, it's just a big lark that it was just sort of like, oh, okay, well, that's done. It was very painful and sad, but it was just like, it is time for the rest of our life to do this differently.
It does bring up something which I think is very important, which is that when you're in your 20s, you can say with all your heart, I will love you forever, and you don't have the slightest idea what you're talking about. In some cases, you might. In some cases, it might work out.
Or they're both just so aligned that they evolve together. But that's incredibly rare. I really do think that it's, I mean, fine to have a starter marriage. It's fine to try it out. If it doesn't work, go on and see what you can do with the rest of your life. I feel that's a change in our society since, Sally, when you were married, you know, and thank you for that generation that fought for that. I mean, not that far behind you, girl, but...
20 years.
Well, you know.
Maybe so many marriages don't work out when we get married as younger people because we are more willing to be jerks. You know, it's like... being petty. I mean, I know that I won't let myself be as petty and snippy as I was before because I understand now how destructive it is. Like, I have no tolerance for being anything but the best person I can be at any given moment in my new relationship.
And I think, you know, in a 30-year relationship like I've had now, at one point, you know, you bicker for the first 10 and you know, it's like turmoil for a while. And then all of a sudden you go, uh-oh, you know what? One of us is going to go first. And you start to think about mortality, and there's a grace in that kind of reflection so that you start to see that person in a more vulnerable way.
I think that's the arc of life that you were just saying, Candace. I mean, when I met my first husband, I was in the most idyllic situation you could imagine, and I was 19. And, you know, I'm not 19 anymore. I don't know how many, you know, the percentage more that I am now. But it's a good thing we didn't have kids together because I don't know how that could have been managed. I was not capable of being a parent then. And this is something I say with my husband now. You know, I got married. He didn't. We both had just as many people that we were deeply in love with before we met each other. And it was like we had to get through all that to be in a place where we could savor what the other one actually had and build that thing. And, you know, our society still pushes girls mostly, but boys too. They get, you have to be the savior and girls have to be the savee. We still have that so prevalent in our culture. You know, you look at any preschool girl, all she wants to be is a princess, which is a euphemism for bride, really, I think. And we're still pushed in that direction so strongly and so heavily.
Well,
and, you know,
there's one thing I discovered this week. I was going through a bunch of old high school albums and junk, trying to get them out of the closet. And one of them fell open to this thing that we had done in junior high school. And it was planning your marriage. And it had... the cake, it had the you know, the bridesmaids' dresses, it had everything planned out and budgeted. And I got to the last page where I'd drawn the wedding, and there was no groom. It was just me. And I thought, you know, from the get-go, girls don't even really understand what that is, except it's some big theatrical event.
Candace, you represent another whole part of the story of divorce, which is... people who get divorced and then end up with a same-sex couple relationship. Do you want to read from your story?
The really great thing about dating women you meet online is that when you're both women, you actually do have a good chance of being friends if the chemistry thing isn't there. Therefore, I soon had a posse of about 15 new women friends to show me the ropes of being in the girl-girl world. And they all really had great Josie and the Pussycats names. We went out to women's themed dances, from leather and lace to informally hemp and hand-painted silk, to a women's land commune to help remod an adobe house, and to potlucks with wide arrays of hummus on offer, and made snarky, gut-bustingly funny comments out the sides of our mouths about what we thought was the lesbian what not to wear. Gia and I went to our first dance together, burned up the dance floor, drank about four too many Cosmos each, and ended up separately being hit on by women who soon thereafter held our hair while we barfed on different ends of the parking lot, and then still wanted to date us. Nancy and I went out to dinner at a resort that had an outdoor swimming pool for guests, which was closed as it was late. "Want to sneak in and skinny dip?" Nancy asked. "No! Well, okay." In we slid, giggling, our breasts bobbing chastely in the warm water, and yes, we did get busted. I made my friends and even got involved two times, enough to know that I really was on the right track and not just having some kind of screw man, I'm going to hide out in flannel pajamas foot rub land reaction. I knew I wasn't, but there was the worry. Both of these encounters ended badly, and with those endings, the deep sorrow of my divorce wound gushed out like Linda Blair's possessed vomit. The first time, I hid my grief from my ex. He had just been getting together with a woman. I knew because he'd stopped asking me daily if I thought that maybe we should get back together, and he'd been picking up the kids in the morning with sex hair. I could not go there with him. I felt weak and scared and protective of my journey thus far. My grief fanned out inside me, immobilized me mornings when I could not for the life of me get out of bed, even to pee. I held it and huddled under the covers. The second time, Will, who had gotten more serious since then with a lovely woman, called me, caught me in tears, and came over straight away, six-pack of sympathy beer in hand. He sat beside me on the couch, wrapped his arms around me, and held me tightly as I unapologetically sobbed about the loss of someone besides himself. But more than I cried about that, I cried out my grief at my deepest fear that I was inherently unlovable and flawed, incapable of being happy ever again, that I was like so many women of my mother's generation who got divorced or had been widowed and spent the rest of their lives monastically solo. "You're a wonderful person," he said. "I married you. That's got to count for something. You and I split up, and it was the right thing to do, and there are lots of other people out there who will appreciate you and enjoy you for who you are. That woman was not right for you. You spent all this time settling for our relationship, which was not enough. That relationship was not enough either. She doesn't drink, she doesn't eat this, she doesn't eat that, she can't stay up past 8, she doesn't want to do lots of fun things. Candace, when there are more don'ts than do's, don't." Those words helped, but more than that, it helped me to cry so hard and so freely and cry on someone who did not really care that I was sliming the hell out of his nice dress shirt. Unlike many ex-lovers I'd wadded up like toilet paper and flushed out of my life, he and I were bound to each other through our children who made us find a common, respectful ground, and even though that was for the good of the children, it was, surprise, good for us as well.
And that is from Candace Walsh's piece from the book Ask Me About My Divorce, Women Open Up About Moving On. And by the way, this book will be read from by various people, perhaps sitting at this table, on June 13th. That's this Saturday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. Sally Blakemore, you got married also in your 20s. You've been married three times, the last one for a very long time.
30 years.
Do you want to read a little section from your essay?
Yes, I think I'll start in the beginning here. In 1967, the summer of love, 20 years after my birth, women still had no real practical human rights in the bizarre land of Texas. You were required to take your husband's name and couldn't qualify for a credit card unless it was through your husband. The 60s sexual revolution was just dropping anchor, and I was happily living with my college boyfriend and going to undergrad in fine arts at the University of Texas in Austin. It all seemed so natural. Innocence overtook me, and I told my parents that he and I were sharing an apartment. Why marry? I liked my name, and I wanted to keep it for my artistic identity. My parents showed up at our garage apartment in the form of an unannounced, violent entry. My father's screaming fury so ferocious that my future husband jumped out of the second-story window and ran for his life. I, however, stayed alone for 3 hours of screaming, humiliating attacks that they now call verbal abuse. My mother remained in the car, reading a Family Style magazine with her fingers in her ears. After the angry scene, they wanted us to dress up, act normal, and they would treat us to dinner like nothing had happened. But my boyfriend declined to join us, and we went on without him. I remember putting pancake makeup over my crying eyes. Water and oil do not mix. I wondered, blinking blankly, who is looking out of these eyes? I didn't even recognize myself. 20 years later, sans eye contact, my mother confessed her experience of that day to me. She told me as she traced her pearly beige fingernail over the skirt of an evening gown and flipped through a women's wear catalog, "I thought Dad was beating you. There was nothing I could do. I didn't really know if you would even come out alive." My future husband's parents from New York were more sophisticated than mine. They had lived in Japan and Hawaii. They saw us as the 20-year-old kids that we were. They thought I was cute and different. My family, wounded, uneducated, Southern Baptist with no grip on reality, considered me an unclean, used whore and decreed that I needed to get married to be cleansed in the eyes of the world and the Lord. I was too naive to realize I had my own life to live. My family was boundaryless with no privacy. Their hypocritical values did not pertain to me at all, but I took them on. My boyfriend and I decided to take off to Santa Fe, New Mexico. We had to think about it. We felt tortured and slimed. On the top floor of a beautiful old hotel filled with Nigerians on an exchange tour, I broke down. The trauma had been bigger than I realized. He, too, was so confused by my father's overbearing demands and my hysterical begging for acceptance and cleansing that he at last agreed. So that's sort of a preface to early marriage in your 20s when you were forced because you were seen as a used car.
Right. Used goods.
Used goods.
It does, when you were reading that, it really made me think about the extent to which the divorce rate, which went up a lot in the 60s and 70s, may be a function of women actually just simply getting rights and having some say in their own lives.
Mm-hmm. Because of course, remember... Oh, pardon me.
I mean, I remember that in the 70s growing up in New York City, you know, like Gail Sheehy, her right. daughter was like a friend of mine at high school, right, when Passages came out. And, you know, being a teenager and looking at that and like... all my friends' parents were getting divorced, and it was like, you know, between the swinging and the divorces and the women asserting themselves, it was just this crazy inside-out world that I was experiencing as, you know, as an observer at the same time as experiencing adolescence. It was pretty intense,
mm-hmm. right?
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that has a lot to do with why we have so much stuff to unpack when it comes to coming to grips with our own divorces, that first it was completely taboo, and then it was this sort of self-indulgent or seen as self-indulgent kind of trend, and that it was sort of just coming out of a reflexive desire to have fun
right and not and, stick with your commitments
right mm-hmm. And so then, you know, there's this whole level of seeming like you lied when you said your vows, and I don't think we did, just things changed. And then it's like, did you lie then, or will you live a lie? And so now I think when we talk about divorce encompasses all of that stuff, and to be able to just peel those onion layers away and have our own experience and protect that.
I think one of the things that is wonderful about this anthology is that it busts the stereotype that women are bereft and somehow like little puddles on the floor when they're great big man leaves them, or when their marriage falls apart. Mm-hmm. Every single woman in this book was strengthened by the process of the dissolution of the marriage and what came after it.
Yes, I think that the flashpoint of creation for this book was I was at a dinner party, and it was on a business trip, and I was sitting next to strangers on either side who didn't know anything about me, and so I was chit-chatting with this woman who's next to me, and it came up that I was getting divorced, and she just said, well, how's that going? And it was a neutral response, and this neutrality created this huge sense of, like, space for me to figure out how I really felt when I wasn't defending myself from, like, huge waves of solicitousness. Right. And then she said, you know, I got divorced 15 years ago, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, it was like this, she was like the sort of poster child for post-divorce success, and that flowed into my space that she created by being neutral. And that's really what made me think that there should be a book about it.
Well, I'm going to read my little passage, if I may. I don't
usually talk
about myself on the air, but since I'm part of this book, I will read one page. We're talking about the book, Ask Me About My Divorce, Women Open Up About Moving On. So I was married to a very amiable Peruvian fellow, and in this part of the essay, we are in Peru. We went to Machu Picchu, a place he knew very well, where he proudly guided tourists, telling them endless stories about the Incas. That day, we were the last people allowed to climb up Huayna Picchu, a tall, steep mountain that towers over the archaeological site. By the time we reached the summit, all the other tourists had left and the gate below was closed. We were alone on a sacred Inca mountaintop, which, according to legend, was the residence for the high priest and the local virgins. Jay looked at me with a combination of tenderness and mischief and said, "Do you want to do? We can conceive our child here." I stared at him. "Now?" "Yes, this is the place of my ancestors. This is a sacred place, and the child we make here will be very special. An Inca and a gringa. A grinca!" We laughed. A door in my heart opened, and I saw clearly that at that moment that the child would be wonderful, as magical and beautiful as this place, with the best qualities of each of us. Jay's friendly and calm nature, my observant intelligence, and both of our endless humor and love of dance and music. But I saw something else. Jay would lead and I would follow, and my choices would be severely constrained. He would do what he wanted, when he wanted, just as his father did, and I would be expected to stay home and do most of the work like his long-suffering mother. I saw the film running in my mind. I was stuck in his parents' house with a baby, bored, waiting for him to come home, hungry for intellectual stimulation or any work of my own. I would devote myself to the health and well-being of my baby, and then Jay would burst in and give it chocolate bars, even when I objected that chocolate wasn't good for a baby, and I didn't want our kid's teeth to rot by the time it was 20, just like many of the silver-toothed Peruvians around us, and I didn't want to mess with its blood sugar. Jay would scoff. He'd be Santa Claus, and I'd be the bitch queen. And there would be no escape except divorce, which would likely damage the child, as my parents' divorce had damaged me. In an instant, I saw the next decade of my life. I decided to leave the film in the can and close it.
Nice.
Very cool.
That's my story. So we're talking about the book, Ask Me About My Divorce, Women Open Up About Moving On. How did you find all the contributors to this book? I mean, the four of us are from Santa Fe, which is where you live, but there are people from all over the country.
Well, I definitely have a rich pool of talented friends here in Santa Fe, in Albuquerque, and I also have friends from online networks, and I work for Mothering Magazine and know some writers through there, and I also put out calls for submissions on many different websites. So, and just recommend, you know, like I just was like, spread the word, forward this to people who you know, and it worked out really well.
What are some of the more surprising submissions that came in? I mean, we won't read from them, but there were some amazing stories.
There was this really fantastic piece that came in from R.M. Hora. India has a much more intense culture around marriage and divorce. It's so taboo. And so for her, she wanted to share this story about getting divorced because her husband came out as being gay. And the irony was that she had enjoyed the fact that he would always buy her the most beautiful saris and he had impeccable taste. Then he came and said on her 40th birthday, "I'm going to give you the gift of truth, which is that I'm gay and that you deserve somebody who can give you the fullness of themselves and not just a part." And when she told her parents about it, expecting to be given sympathy, that they tried to say that it was because she had not done her wifely duty in some way, and maybe that why couldn't his friend move in too, and that they could all make it work, because otherwise they would be ashamed of having a divorce in their happen in their family. So I just thought that was really gnarly.
Amazing. I mean, it's a wonderful book. There's so many. I love books like this where people talk about things that they've really, that you've never really heard before in the public sphere. These are kind of the stories that women tell each other over breakfast or over coffee, but not things that you're really used to reading. I mean, I think I don't want to diminish the gravity and importance of divorce. I mean, there are reasons why it's taboo, and one of them is children and not wanting to damage the children. And you know, as a child of divorce, that was very hard for me. And what about you? You have two, Candace, little children.
Yeah, you know, I feel fortunate in that I grew up in a loveless house. My parents stayed together until I was 13, but I basically kind of knew it in my cellular makeup that they were really not fulfilled and couldn't stand each other, and there was not that love that kind of flowed throughout, and I felt it. I felt like I knew that they weren't really supposed to be together at this point, and that I was just waiting for them to figure it out. So I think that, you know, if children grow up with two people who don't love each other, then they don't really know what love looks like day to day. And I know personally that when I was in my marriage, that I was depressed. I was deeply depressed, and I did the bare minimum to get through. And my kids had a depressed mother. They don't have that now.
You know, my parents were so miserable that for Christmas one year, I gave them a do-it-yourself divorce kit, thinking I could really help them. And they were just shocked and appalled that I'd even noticed. But my father was quite the philanderer, and mother was always just a victim. So it was this hideous
long-suffering.
Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah. And what happened next?
They stayed together till the end.
One does hear stories of people who had 20 miserable years in the middle, but then in their retirement they get happy again.
Oh, no. Well, actually, it was interesting. When mother died, they say that as you're dying, someone comes to take you to the other side. And she sat straight up in bed and she said, "He's here. He told me that I was the only one he ever loved."
And your father had already died?
He'd already died. And that was the thing that released her. She had waited her entire marriage and existence to have those words said. Isn't that tragic?
That's very intense.
Amazing.
I mean, the notion of fidelity and divorce and infidelity and philandering and divorce is worthy of an entire
book.
Second sequel book. Because, I mean, you know, there's some stuff in the public news right now about a high-profile politician whose wife just said, you know, "I love him anyway." And, I mean, you know, what? Who are we to say what love is, you know?
I know.
Mean, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't know. I mean, some people may have to be sad to be fulfilled. That might be some people's way of being on this earth.
Mm-hmm.
But not mine and not yours.
I know who you're referring to. And when I read the article about that situation, there were places that she just wouldn't let herself go. Like, "I won't think about her or that baby, and that has nothing to do with my life." And I just figured, gosh, you know, talk about putting blinders on. Talk about lessening your ability to be present in the moment and just to flow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're like throwing up this wall here and this wall here.
But
right.
But for some people, that I just feel like that's what she has to do in order to survive what she's going through. And I mean, I think it's great that all of us in this anthology have come out on the other side better, stronger, you know, the Olympic stronger, faster, higher, you know. But I do also think, like, you know, I have many relatives who stayed in marriages that were not fulfilling because the notion of fulfillment wasn't even on the table for them. And it became about survival. It became about having someone to share the bills with. It became about, you know, it came about different things. And we, you know, if I look at it outside of the prism of my middle class life and my own, like, eternal striving to be happier and better and put it in a different context, I'm a little more forgiving of those people like your mom who are just like, "This is what my life is." I find the story about the Indian woman, though, fascinating, that the family would rather have this sort of menage a trois kind of
you know, like cash up ball type of story than dare to have this stigma of a divorce.
Divorce.
I think the next book should be about divorce from an international perspective.
Very
interesting.
Yeah, you, Candace, you're doing a number of anthologies.
That's the plan.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All this and much, much more in the book, Ask Me About My Divorce, Women Open Up About Moving On. It's an anthology edited by Candace Walsh. Candace, Sally Blakemore, and Rosie Kennedy, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And once again, at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, June 13th from 2 to 3, there will be a book launch. We'll see you there. I'd like now to welcome Dick Jones. He's district governor of Rotary International District 5520, and Zelly Pollan. She's a journalist. She's a recipient of two Rotary fellowships, past and present. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank
Good morning.
You, Mary Charlotte.
So what is Rotary International? We've heard of it's the Rotary Club. There's tens of thousands of them worldwide. What are they?
There's 32,000 worldwide. There's three in Santa Fe. And Rotary is the oldest service organization, founded in 1905 by a guy in Chicago. And since then, it has grown to over 32,000 clubs around the world and 1.2 million Rotarians.
And so what do the Rotarians do?
They do all kinds of service projects. They're primarily community-based, so there are projects in all communities that address the needs of that community. For instance, one of the clubs here in Santa Fe had a dedication for a landscaping project at one of the transitional shelters in town. They're going to be raising about $15,000 over the summer to make this a very pleasant experience for the residents who are transitioning from homeless to the work environment. So that's one example of the projects that Rotary does. Another is our Polio Plus project, which started in 1988 when a couple of Rotarians got to talking about how bad the polio endemic virus was affecting the rest of the world. At the time, the United States was pretty much polio-free and has remained so, but around the world it was a totally devastating disease, killing and maiming 300,000 people annually. So they got together, they started raising money, they established a process for taking the live polio vaccine into countries all over the world, and now we're down to four countries that have wild polio virus and less than 1,000 cases. So this is a project that we've dedicated ourselves to.
Now, you think this is the kind of thing that the World Health Organization would do?
We're in partnership with the World Health and CDC and a lot of large corporations, including the Microsoft Foundation. Bill Gates, a year ago, gave Rotary $100 million to fight polio and was so impressed with the process that he came back this year and gave Rotary another $255 million to fight polio.
That's a lot of money.
That's a bunch of money. And one of the reasons that he is in the foundation is so supportive of Rotary and this effort is because there's an expectation by the Gates Foundation that Rotary will support the effort by raising $200 million of their own. So we've got a $550 million commitment, which is on top of all the money that's been raised. So probably close to $2 billion had been raised by Rotary for
There's another amazing story that you were telling me before we went on the air about the incidence of cervical cancer in Guatemala.
Actually, in Guadalajara, Mexico.
Oh, I'm sorry, Guadalajara.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Several years ago, one of our Rotarians from Santa Fe was visiting her family in Guadalajara. And she was visiting this women's shelter and asked if there was anything that Rotary could do. And they said, well, we need sheets, bed sheets. And so they went out and they bought bolts of linen and paid the local people to cut them up and make sheets for this health clinic. Went back the next year, and they had the same request. And at that point, she became quite curious as to why there had been so many sheets being used in the clinic, and found out that, in fact, the sheets were being used as burial shrouds. So the conversation got to, well, how can we help to fight this problem? And as a result, a project was put together here in Santa Fe between the three Rotary Clubs and District 5520, which is Rotary Clubs in New Mexico and West Texas, and Rotary International, and raised $30,000 to buy seven Zeiss microscopes that were given to the clinic. And since that time, 2,000 women have been diagnosed in the early stages of cervical cancer, and their lives can directly be related to that project.
So basically, all these women were dying of cervical cancer because of the lack of microscopes.
Yes, because they did not have the equipment for early diagnosis, something that here in the United States we pretty much take for granted.
So you've also solved the bedsheet problem.
Yep. We solved the bedsheet problem.
Not to make light of it. I mean, it's unbelievable. So you do all these services locally and around the world. You do youth programs.
We do youth programs. We have a number of youth programs. We have what would be, in effect, a junior Rotary in some of the high schools. And we also have a youth leadership camp that we hold each summer. 1 week in July is for girls. One week later, we have the camp for boys. We have about 100 students from across the area that go to the camp and learn leadership skills, which are based on Rotary's founding principles of high ethical business standards. And they spend a week there. We also have one of our more popular programs is Youth Exchange, where we send about 17 students from across New Mexico to a dozen foreign countries to study their senior year of high school. And the exchange part is that we take in between 20 and 30 students from those same countries into New Mexico and West Texas for their senior year in high school. And because one of the beliefs of Rotary is that world peace is based on individuals getting to know other individuals. It's person-to-person contact. And so we have done a lot in that respect. A couple of our programs are scholarship programs that Zaylee has been a participant in, and can tell us about those.
I have actually been incredibly fortunate to now be on the receiving end of two Rotary fellowships. And what first attracted me to Rotary, I'm going to say it was one of those people who didn't know a thing about Rotary. I mean, I had this idea of, you know, a bunch of kind of white people sitting around having lunch together and exchanging business cards. And it was really by chance that I was searching on the website one day and saw that they were advertising for a peace and conflict studies program in Bangkok, Thailand. It was a short-term program directed at people who are already in the field. I was on my way to graduate school to Johns Hopkins, and I saw this and I thought, this really looks incredible. And based on what Rotary had on the website, it looks like they are incredibly dedicated to world peace in a way that other people are not. This was, at the time, and I didn't know it, a brand new program that they had begun. What they had previously was a World Peace Fellowship. It's a 1 to 2 year master's program. They send World Peace Fellows from around the world to one of six universities at this point to complete their master's. They pay for everything. Apparently, the Peace and Conflict Studies was actually born out of that for a shorter-term program, people in the field. A third scholarship program that they have are ambassadorial scholarships, also for a master's degree. The difference between this is the ambassadorial scholarship is $25,000 toward any university of your choice.
Uh-huh.
The World Peace Fellowship is all expense paid,
everything, your flight, your living expenses, your tuition, for the duration of this program, you do have to choose one of the universities that they have listed, and you cannot attend a university in your program. So I am actually on my way to England, having already completed the shorter-term peace and conflict studies program in Thailand. I met so many people from the University of Bradford in England. I was completely impressed that these are the kind of people who are dedicated to world peace, to really changing the way conflict is looked at and to how it's solved, if it can be solved or at least transformed.
What did you learn?
In the short-term program?
Yeah.
The short-term program was separated into modules, and we really looked at dissecting conflict into what makes it, what are the ingredients of a conflict? Is it around resources? Is it around identity? And then we looked at different models. We discussed different conflicts. I mean, the thing that was amazing, I was the only American chosen for this program, and I was there with 20 other people from around the world. I was one of only two females, and they all came from different regions that have conflict, from northern India, from Thailand, from Bangkok, Philippines. And they were all there talking about the various conflicts. In Sri Lanka, we had a Tamil, we had a Sinhalese, so that was really fascinating, dissecting it. And we talked about history and how these conflicts progressed. We also visited different sites of conflict at the time and then talked about different ways of resolution. But the part about this that was amazing is that Rotary International has contacts with people all over the world. They brought in university professors, people from different NGOs and governmental organizations to talk about the work they'd been doing. And that was really, really incredible and enlightening. And you know, here in the U.S., we hear about some of the conflicts in the Middle East and now maybe Pakistan. We have no idea about the conflicts in northern India. We have no idea. So really being able to discuss some of these different ones and to look at the similarities was really, really valuable for me. But it exposed me to the kind of models and to the kind of people working that I wanted to work with. Right. I wanted to be in connection to. And so I deferred from Johns Hopkins. I said, okay, wait a minute. Let me rethink this. And I applied for the World Peace Fellowship and was chosen as a World Peace Fellow, and as I said, we'll be going to England. So hopefully I'll be able to report back on what that was. But again, I just want to say that I was so impressed by Rotary International's dedication to peace, the amount of resources that they are putting towards this, to supporting students and leaders throughout the world to really promote peace was incredible. And of course, when I was in Thailand, and I understand when I'm in England, you have to interact with Rotarians all over the country, all different clubs. And everyone was so dedicated. The kind of projects they had on a local level and on an international level was phenomenal. I mean, the dedication these people have is really amazing. And so everywhere I go, people say, well, how did you find out about this? I don't understand. How did you get so lucky? And I say, I just found out about the information, and I applied. I mean, we have people here all over New Mexico who are incredibly talented and who could also benefit from these fellowships. And I certainly hope that people will go. We have actually information on the local website, rotary5520.org. You can go to scholarships to find out about the application process and the interview process, and it is quite in-depth. They really want to choose people who they know will go forward and will be good representatives for Rotary. I certainly hope I fit that bill as best I can.
You wouldn't have been chosen if you didn't, no doubt. There's also a commitment to business ethics. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Tell us about that whole piece of it.
Well, Rotary was based on fellowship and high business ethics. And as a result, we have several documents that kind of the organization is built around. One is called the four-way test. It's a simple 24-word pledge that Rotarians keep in the forefront of their life and use as kind of a decision matrix in their business. It was started in the early 30s.
What are some of the questions on it?
Well, it's basically, is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendship? Is it beneficial to all concerned?
Have you been to Wall Street lately?
No, I have not. And obviously, they're lacking of Rotarians, but...
Certainly.
Well, so all of this is happening, and there's also, of course, a social aspect of it. A close friend of mine's parents are Rotarians, and wherever they go in the world, they stay with other Rotarians. They meet new people, and it's the most friendly and open-hearted, open-their-house-to-you group of people.
Sure.
Everywhere.
We have a program called Fellowship Exchange, where Rotarians from New Mexico would go, or District 5520 would go to England, and they'll stay in the home of Rotarians in England.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, the folks from England will come to New Mexico, West Texas, and stay. And I have a very close personal friend that just returned from a trip to Canada, and he said it was the most awesome experience he had had because they learned about the community in depth. It would be like coming to Santa Fe and living here for 10 years and having that all compressed into a two-week period because you're in contact with these people that know it. I mean, things a tourist wouldn't be exposed to.
Right. I would highly recommend if traveling to Asia and visiting any Rotarians that you learn a lot of karaoke songs, however. That seems to be a big part of the culture.
Oh, boy.
Unbeknownst to me starting out.
Luckily, that's not part of the local culture.
Dick Jones is district governor of Rotary International District 5520. Zaylee Pollan is a journalist. She's a recipient of two Rotary fellowships, is going to England on one of these fellowships this coming fall. Rotary can be, local chapter can be found at rotary5520.org. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, good morning, jazz.